Good evening. My name is Karen Williams, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. My God-given sobriety date is May 9th, 1998. My home group is by the book that meets on Mondays from 7 to 8:30 p.m. in Fresno, California. So I guess I'm an out-of-towner. I want to thank Bill for asking me to speak and wish him a happy recovery. He's ill. And I want to thank all of you for coming out this evening when it's wet and rainy and damp. Thank you. Thank you. Oh. I'm going to start with what it was like for me before I even started drinking. Because some of the things that happened to me as a child growing up, I wasn't even aware of until I got older before I came into sobriety. And so this will sort of tell you what kind of a person I was coming into my drinking and coming into my sobriety. I can remember being told by my mom at a very early age that I was premature, I was breech, and I wasn't a boy, and that's why my father left. And so from then on, it seemed like I had this inner thought that everything was my fault, was my job to fix it, and it would always be this way. And the utmost thing is, we never told anybody our family secrets. I was to act and behave like father knows best. I'm telling you, you know, how old I am now. And the Brady Bunch and the Danny Thomas Show. So when I went to school or I went anywhere, you know, I acted like I was the fairy tale person in the book, that there was nothing wrong. And what people didn't know is that from the age of 6 months until I was 10, I was shuffled back and forth between a foster home and living with my mom. My mother was what I call today an outrageous alcoholic. She's the material that books are written about. She's the material that movies are made of. The stories are humorous. But as a child living through them and experiencing that, it was pretty tragic. And I can remember from a very early age two things. Number one, I wanted my mom to love me. And number two, I was never going to grow up and be an alcoholic like my mom. So pretty much by the time I was 10, I went back to live with my mom and became the caretaker of a 5-year-old sister. I was the cook. I was the cleaner. I was my mother's emotional significant other. I was the person she abused when she was drinking, and I was also going to school. So, and what I'm trying to point out here is that emotionally, you know, I came into program at 51 years old, and emotionally on a good day, I was somewhere between 5 and 7, and I don't know if you got stunted emotionally, but I did. I did, and I didn't know it. And the other thing I didn't know is that I was stunted spiritually. When I came into program at 51, the closest thing that I can say that it is that I was still looking at that picture of Jesus and coloring in his shoes and his beard and knowing that there was a God behind the cloud. And that was about as much as I got from church or religion. And, of course, all the crosstalk that everybody had, you know, in back of it. So very early, I became an agnostic. And my agnosticism looked like this. If there is a God, doesn't do anything for me, doesn't affect my life, so it really doesn't matter. And so one of the other things that I came to find out is that I was always looking on the outside to fix something wrong on the inside. So I was fortunate enough, I graduated from college, left home that summer to get away from my mother, was told I needed to go to college, so I went to college. That didn't make me happy. I got a good job, because I was told if you get a good job, you'll be happy. That didn't make me happy. I married my high school sweetheart. Certainly that was going to make me happy. No, I wouldn't say there was contentment there. And as I look back, you know, I was always trying to please him. Or, and this word, I thought about it today, because I asked God, reveal to me what it was that I was doing, because I didn't have a temper tantrum, because, you know, you get in a lot of trouble if you get temper tantrums, you get beat up. So I would pout. And pout is probably the best word. As an adult woman, that if things weren't going my way, I would pout, and the typical, what's the matter? Nothing. Well, what's the matter? Nothing. And I expected by some form of osmosis for my husband to know what I wanted, what I was thinking, and how I wanted to communicate with him. Because whatever that part about growing up where you're told how to communicate with people and be honest, that wasn't a part of me. Because those were secrets. Those were deep secrets. So, of course, what's the next step? Had a child. Greatest thing that ever happened to me. But it wasn't enough. You know, it was something, but it wasn't enough. So what's the next thing to make me happy? Got a divorce. That certainly was going to make me happy. I'd been with him for 17 years. Things weren't working out. So what do? You get a divorce. And I love this story because it goes to show how sick I was. And, you know, I haven't said anything about drinking yet, have I? Okay. Is I can remember we were laying in bed, and my little tot was about 5 years old, and his dad said, you know what, I think we should have another child. And I turned and looked at him, and in all sincerity said, I want a divorce. And you know, he didn't understand. He didn't understand. Of course, he was gone by that Saturday because I had a date that night, because that was really going to make me happy, is to go back, you know, into the dating scene. And that's where I started drinking. I started drinking socially, and it was fun. It was really fun, because I got to start being the person that I thought I'd never been, and seemed to be a solution to everything. When I was drinking, I don't know how it was for you, but when I was drinking, I could solve all the problems. What's your problems? It's just that the next morning when I thought about what those solutions were, they didn't make a lot of sense. But they sure made a lot of sense when I was drinking. And then I started drinking more. Well, remember, I keep secrets. So I drank at home. And I'm what they call a closet drinker. And I would drink on Friday nights and Saturdays and Saturday night and Sunday night. And maybe till 2 o'clock Monday morning, but see, that was still Sunday night, because I hadn't gone to sleep yet. And get up and have a job and be a little jittery and think, well, gosh, you know, I must be having some nervous problems here. Because I wasn't doing the kind of things my mom had done. And if your story is like mine, the drink started to catch up with me. And it became everything. And everything that I did was based on drinking. And I have a very small family, my sister and her two daughters and my son. And they would do the typical things, and the big book talks about this, you know, telling me that maybe I had a problem, maybe I needed to stop drinking. Certain things would happen, and I'd say, oh, you know what, I need to quit. And I could quit. I even quit one time for a couple of months, but I could never stay stopped. Or I guess the thing is I could stop, but I could never quit. And so pretty soon I was taking, you know, the middle of the week off and more days off. And by that time I'm an educator and I was in an administrative position. So they didn't need a substitute to cover for me. And I would lie and I wouldn't tell the truth about what was happening. And then the time, and I, you know, I was not going to social events. I was no longer dating because, I mean, my date became the drink. You know, my socializing became the drink. I was what they call a true closet drunk. And I can tell you in full honesty and look you in the face and say, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I thought the drink was helping me solve my problems. It was taking away my worries. I just was totally oblivious, that insanity of not knowing what's going on. And then what happened is I drank for 9 days straight. And I woke up someplace I'd never been before. And it scared me. That had never happened before. And I had never drank that much. And I sort of, you know, had that panic. And I, of course, was wasn't going to tell anybody, and I called work every day. You know, the first day I wasn't feeling well. The second day I had a flu. The third day I had pneumonia. The fourth day I forget what I had. The fifth day I called up and I said, yeah, I think I had a slight heart attack. They didn't believe that one. So somebody called me and they said, excuse me, what's going on with you, Karen? I said, oh, I think I had a heart attack. And she said, did you go to the doctor? And I said, no, it was a real small one. And she responded with, well, if you want to talk to me, you know, my number. And I thought, well, that's an odd thing to say, you know. So I thought about it for a while, had a couple more drinks. And I called her back, and this was a woman that I greatly admired and had worked for in previous years. And her name was Lynn, and I said, I've been drinking. And you know what she said? She said, I know you have. And it was like, how did she know that? And she asked me if I was going to be alone for the weekend. It was Mother's Day weekend. And I want to share this because of what I'm going to talk about in the book. My son meant a lot to me. And by this time, he was about 24 years old. And he and my sister were both coming over. And now, here's the picture, okay? I said a nine-day drunk. What I didn't tell you is hadn't brushed my teeth, hadn't combed my hair, hadn't taken a shower, hadn't sponged bath, had stayed in the same nightgown, had stayed in the same robe, only had one pair of slippers. I was a sight to behold. And I'm sitting in this chair looking at my son and my sister and finally being able to say to them, I think I might have a problem with alcohol. My sister is sobbing, just sobbing, because, you know, it's just another program. And my son is just sitting there just looking at me, just staring at me. And I can remember, you know how there's some things as you get older, you just know you're never going to forget them in life, and this is one of them. And as I'm talking, he's just looking at me with that look that men can give you, you know, or to give me with no expression. And I remember that feeling, I have lost the most important individual in my life. And he looked at me and he said, Mom, I'm so proud of you. And it just totally blew me away. And he left, and then he called me, and he said, hey, Mom, I've got somebody that I want you to talk to. Now, unbeknownst to me, he'd been going to Al-Anon in college. And so he sent a man over to me that sat at my table, and this man called and said, can I come over and see you tonight about 5 o'clock? And I'm thinking, well, gosh, I don't know. You know, I haven't brushed my teeth, haven't taken a, you know, still in that state of not knowing and coming off of 9 days of a drunk and foggy and shaking and not able to eat and nervous and agitated. And I said, well, yeah, I guess that would be okay. You know, I don't know what else I thought I was going to do. And he came over and sat at my kitchen table, just like the big book says. And he told me a story. And all of a sudden, I realized that he had felt the same way I felt. And he had thought some of the same things I was thinking. And it's that connection that the big book talks about of one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. It's like when I go through Bill's story. You know, like we say, I'm not a stockbroker, I'm not a man, I had a child, but when I color-coded my book and showed, you know, what did I feel like and what happened to me, I'm in there. That story is part of my story. Your story is part of my story. You know, that common bond that we have of being alcoholics. Anyway, that Monday I was sent to an alcoholic counselor, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with that little green slip. Well, it could be any color, but it's a little slip, and you answer the 15 questions, and it has to do about alcoholism. So, of course, you know, I have, you know, 3 postgraduate degrees, and I'm very intelligent, and I'm very bright. And I parked my car 2 blocks away and didn't take my purse with me because I thought I could always run out of this house and, you know, over the bushes. And when the nutty car came, I'm 51 years old, and I think the white van is going to pull up with the guys in the white outfit and strap me down and take me, you know, to a loony bin. Because I didn't know what a closet drunk looked like. I had no clue. I didn't know anybody else like me. So I'm answering those questions, and of course I'm being very coy, and there's 15 of them, and I leave three blank, or I answer no instead of yes. Well, then you get down to the bottom, and it says if you answered one of these, there's a possibility. If you answered two, you might want to be concerned, and if you answered more than three, join the group, honey, you're an alcoholic. And all I thought was shit, and I lied on the three of them. I was all 15. So I was sent to a women's AA meeting. And all I can tell you is not believing in a God changed that day without me knowing it. Because I walked into this room. Now, remember, my mother had told me Alcoholics Anonymous was a bunch of men sitting at a bar drinking, you know, out of paper bags. I'm 51 years old. I'm thinking, and this guy sent me to a church. So I walk in, and here's a group of women sitting at tables, and they're laughing, and they're joking, and they're welcoming me in, and they're dressed. You know, like, sort of like a garden club, for lack of a better word. You know, working class women. I wasn't down at the Sparrow House or, you know, down in the Salvation Army. But they were still alcoholics, and that's what I needed at that time to relate to. And I can't tell you what happened, but you know those balloon arches they have at football fields? And how sometimes the lights go off? That's sort of what happened for just a split instant when I walked through that door. And for some reason, nobody had shared, nobody had given me a big book yet. I hadn't read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all of a sudden, I felt home. There was something, some feeling that was undescribable that you couldn't see, that I felt, this is where I belong. This is, and I'm sorry I don't have one of those horrible, funny, tragic stories. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I found Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've stayed. Now, what I did is I got a sponsor whose husband was in the same profession as my ex-husband, because I thought I could probably relate to her better. And so she took me through the steps. And I had that sponsor for 5 years. And after 5 years, I felt like something was missing. I didn't feel like drinking, but I just wasn't fulfilled. And what I know today, it wasn't, is I didn't have that spiritual connection yet. I was still looking out there. I was still looking for you to tell me, you did a good job. You look good today. You know, I was looking for affirmation from my peers. So I got a sponsor that was duly addicted, and instead of taking me through the big book, she thought it would be a great idea to take me through a sister's program's workbook. So I went through that workbook, and I changed all the words that weren't alcohol or alcoholic to alcohol and put a brown cover on it because I didn't want anybody to know that, you know, I was doing that program. And in the meantime, I had been told, you know, go to meetings. So I went to meetings, working full-time, and I went to 5 to 9 meetings a week. I was just checking the clock there. And I was told to get in service. So, of course, I was a secretary at 6 months, and then I was a treasurer, and then I was told to get in general service. Because people in general service, I was told, have a greater rate of sobriety in staying in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I became a GSR, and then I became a DCM. And then I started helping out at central office. And I was secretary, and I was co-chair, and I was PICPC. And I did all those things. And yet, at 10 years of sobriety, I wasn't getting something, and I didn't know what it was. And I found a particular person, and I did, you know, the sin of all sins. I asked a man to be my sponsor, and I don't know about you, but my 10 years of sobriety said, oh, no, no 13th step, and no. And he was the same age as my son, and I was embarrassed to tell anybody. And then I went to his home group, and I started hearing people talk about the big book. And what I came to understand is that I had never connected with our book. I had always kept it Bill's book, your book, your book, your book. I had never made it Karen's book and had a personal relationship with the book. And when that happened, something inside of me changed. And my sponsor did. Oh, and by the way, in like 10 years, not a whole bunch of people were asking me to sponsor them. Okay, as I reflect back on that, I'm thinking, wow, I must have really had something people wanted because I made them go away. So one of the things he told me is that he was a guide, and he was taking me through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous so that I could take other people through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was a channel. I wasn't an end. I was a channel, and nobody had ever told me that before. And he instilled in me that this book is mine, and I'm to question things that are in the book that I don't understand. And I'm to share with other people that want the same thing. And in reflection, I began to see out of those 5 to 9 meetings, very often there wasn't even a big book in the room. Because I was going to meetings, and I'm not putting those meetings down, because this is what I did. And I'm not saying it was different than that. I'm just telling you how I interpreted it. But I went to meetings, mostly women's meetings, because I was still a little uncomfortable with men. But I did go to some co-ed meetings. But what I heard were problems. And if I heard a solution, it was another person's solution. It wasn't following the guidelines, the steps that are in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at some point, working with my sponsor, and I would wish this for everyone, maybe you all got it and I'm just slow, I don't know. But today, what I know is in my solar plex, there's that point. There's that essence. There's that feeling inside of me that is my God part, my creator part, my spirit part. And what I know today is that fills me up. I'm not looking for something out there to fill something that can't be filled. And when that happened, there was such a sense of peace and contentment that came over me. Now, I'm not going to tell you I always feel peace and contentment, because I don't. I fluctuate back and forth sometimes on a minute to minute, hour to hour, daily, of getting back in self, and I have to stop and I have to pray. And I learned to do things in the Big Book that I hadn't read before. Things like 10 steps. Whoa, what a concept. Do an 11th step in the morning and at night. Whoa, what a concept. Offer to sponsor people. Whoa, what a concept. And what I want to talk about for the rest of tonight that I'm going to talk is something that I had to ask God about for the last couple of days. But something happened in the last couple of weeks, and it has to do with the promises. And I was looking at a bookmark, and it says the promises up at the top. Now, this takes a lot of courage for me to share this with you, but this is where, if anybody hears this tonight, that's what I'm supposed to do. That's all I can tell you. It's because I was told, I was guided to do what I'm going to do right now. And it's the 9th step promises. The 9th step promises are wonderful, but they're 9th step promises. They're not the only promises in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to a women's meeting that was a Steps and Promises meeting. And what they did was you take the step and then you take the first promise of the 9th step. And so what you were doing is you were taking each of the, there happens to be 12 of them. This is just spiritually where I am right now. You don't have to agree with it. There happens to be 12 of them. And because of not going through the Big Book and reading it for ourselves and studying it, I made an assumption, because that group made an assumption, that those 9th step promises are aligned with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're not. And that's what I want to share with you right now. For me, one of the first promise was on the title page, when it said, thousands of women have recovered. Whoa. That's a promise. You know, when I opened that up and I saw that worked for other women, that could work for me too. And the word recovered, I've been saying I'm recovering. That's up to you, whatever you want. All I know is the Big Book says at least 26 times that we recover from alcoholism. It also says we get well. Now, it does not say, I am cured. And it does say, I have a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual well-being. And one of the things that I've come to realize is I don't want tomorrow what I have today spiritually. You know, I still have that I want more, because I don't want the spirituality that I had yesterday. Because today I have something deeper than that. And until the day I die, I'm going to do what the big book tells me to do, so that every day I can get closer to my Creator, so I can get closer to God. And have that essence tell me, you know, what do you want me to do? You know, I've gone through the steps. I've set up my ideals of what my life's supposed to look like. That's a goal. What my sex ideals are. Wow, when I did that, I'd never thought about those kind of things in a relationship. Those things come first. Then the big book goes on to say, you know, the basic text. This is our basic text. This is a textbook. I'm a teacher. I can do a textbook. It's not a novel. I think I treated it like it was a novel and just read the parts that I wanted to read. It's helped large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recover. That's a promise. I can find recovery. Things like in the foreword to the second edition, it is our great hope that all those who have yet found no answer may begin to find one in the pages of this book and will presently join us on the high road to a new freedom. So if I engage in this program, that's a promise. You know, it doesn't have to say, Karen, this is a promise. It's just like the prayers. There's more prayers in this book than I ever knew there were, because I was just looking for the one that says, now pray. You know? It didn't dawn on me that ask God meant pray. It just didn't dawn on me. You know, these ideals and the doctor's opinion must be grounded in a power greater than themselves, greater than me, if I'm to recreate my life. So if I ground myself in a power greater than myself, that power is going to recreate my life. Whoa! I don't know about you, but that just sent a chill down my whole, you know, part here. That can happen. I went through and I sort of marked these because I don't memorize stuff. I was soon to be, you know, in Bill's story. And before, this was in hindsight, he's saying this, not as he looked back. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Whoa! That means I can be catapulted into that fourth dimension. I can find peace. I can find happiness. You know, that this is a revelation to me when I go through and read these things. Nearly all have recovered. Sounds like a promise to me. Now, there's some stipulations on that, yeah, you know, do what we did. We have deep and effective emotional experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards ourselves and towards God's universe. Just by doing what the big book says, just by having that connection with God to ultimately work with other people so that they can have the same thing, so they can work with other people, so they can have the same thing, so maybe the whole world can live in happiness and peace and joy. I don't know. You know, they appear to be, and this is talking about there is a solution. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements, ideas, emotions, and attitudes. I hope what you heard when I was talking about growing up were my ideas, my emotions, and my attitudes that ruled my life. I ruled my own life. You know, part of step one, my life was unmanageable. I was happy coming in Alcoholics Anonymous and just not drinking. And I'm getting so much more out of it. You know, if I had not worked the steps and done what I've done and working with other people, I would be denied what the Creator wants to give me. You know, that thing about I can't imagine because I'm not capable. You know, I don't know what I don't know. Every day things happen and I go, oh, I didn't know that. Now I do. Those things are no longer a guiding force in my life on a daily basis. How am I doing on time here? The most wonderful, but the agnostics, I'm sorry, it's not we agnostics, it's care in this chapter is to you. The whole thing is highlighted. That the main object of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Whoa! For the person that said, if there's a God, maybe it's okay, but it doesn't affect me, to sit down and read that, I don't have to solve my own problems anymore? That I'm not the end of end all? Bye. Hope it wasn't me. Or maybe I do. I don't know. We commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. That was, I don't know what it is. I did what we call a God exercise in my line of, or lineage of sponsorship. And when I finished that and saw the glory and saw the infiniteness and the soul of my not understanding how magnificent that power is, it was totally overwhelming. It was a spiritual experience for me. We found that God does not make too hard terms for those who seek him. Sounds like a promise to me. So you see where I'm going with this? As I start reading it and I find, on every page. And to just think there's only the 12 promises and the 9 steps is to cut myself short, to cut the people I work with short. More than that, it's to cut this book short. It's been proven repeatedly among us that this simple cornerstone is a wonderful, effective spiritual structure upon which a spiritual structure can be built. I didn't know what that meant. I probably read that 15, 20 times. And probably the first 5 or 6 times just sort of glossed over it like, yeah, those are nice words, Bill. Thank you very much. But as I'm going back through the book now, with a group of people that I'm studying with, we take it line by line and we study it and we talk about it and we think about it and go, wow, in my world, words carry strength. The world I live in, words carry power. And that's what's right here is words. So this is my power. We could not make use of spiritual principles unless we accepted many things on faith, which seem difficult to believe. Do you think that means I have to give up everything I believe and to trust God? And I feel like I need to put one of those signs on my fanny that says, you come a long way, baby. there's just so many. I've got these all marked, and I think one of the ones that had the greatest impact on me in the last 2 years is on We Agnostics on page 55, where it says we can only clear the ground a bit if our testimony helps sweep away any prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, then if you wish, you can join us. With this attitude, you cannot fail. Sounds like a promise to me. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. Well, that says, Karen, the consciousness of your beliefs are sure to come to you, meaning you're going to have a spiritual awakening. If you sweep away this prejudice, and every time I sit in a meeting and I think, I don't have a prejudice about that. I don't think that. I find out God reveals to me things that those old beliefs, those old truths, lowercase t, that I'm still living my life on. Because part of me is still self-will run riot. Based in fear, that's what the big book says. Based in fear and self-reliance. I don't want to get up here and have you look, have people leave and think I offended them and have you look at me go, well, you did it. It's like, that's not what it is anymore. It's like, I really felt a need tonight to share with whoever showed up that, don't sell ourselves short on what's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and just go by what a lot of people tell us to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Challenge it. Find out if it's your own truth. And I belong to a group that does that. We question each other. We even call each other on our stuff. It's a better word for it, you know. You know, that the end of we agnostics, even so, have God restored us to our right minds? Sounds like a promise to me. To my right mind, what's my right mind? To do God's will. You getting tired of this? Yeah? Huh. Say, you're so kind. Thank you so much. I'll talk good about you guys when I go home. I love this in how it works. If we have been spiritually sick, when the spiritual malady is overcome by working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, we straighten out mentally and physically. Now, I don't know about you. Oh, man, I don't know if I want to say this on tape. But when I was drinking, I very often was in the shower puking and having diarrhea and bleeding all at the same time with a drink on the ledge of the shower, thinking, well, it's my age. Certainly this happens to everyone. First thing I did, and if you're new or relatively new in the program, first thing I did is I went to my doctor. And God blessed me with physical, you know, quality. I also went to my dentist, because remember, you know, I'm, you know, a little, you know, OCD because there too. And he thought that was very humorous and laughed, and he said, alcohol doesn't affect your teeth. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but what I know is it didn't affect my teeth. And that was important at that time. One of the greatest places, and you may all know this, maybe I'm, you know, talking to the choir, I don't know, but the step five, eight promises are in here. Once we have taken the step five, what's step five? Telling somebody else all my secrets to where I am naked. Not physically. Once we have taken this step with holding nothing, we are delighted. We look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Sounds like a promise to me. Once I've taken this step, this is what's going to happen. And I was certainly open to it this last time. And it happened for me. And all I know is if it can happen for me, it can certainly happen for other people. I don't know if this is a promise or not, but one of the things that I was looking at today as I was reviewing this and thinking about coming and talking to you was our behavior will convince them more than our words, which means my behavior will convince others more than my words. And that's sort of a promise that I need to keep to myself, that I need to do what the program tells me to do. You know, I need to come to Visalia when I don't want to. Mostly fear, not time, fear. But there's lots of times where, you know, there's a meeting I know I should go to, and you know, I don't want to have to get up and get dressed and go out and get in the car and do all that stuff. I just, it's much more comfortable for me to stay home. Because I have all my gadgets and I can just sit in one place and do whatever and I live alone. So, you know, hey, it's cool. What I know is when I get up and I go to those meetings, even if it's a meeting that doesn't talk about the big book, maybe it's a place where I'm supposed to be there to say something that someone else needs to hear. More often I find my experiences, I need to be there because there's something somebody's going to say that I need to hear. And I get in my car, I can't tell you how many times, and thank you, like to see some of you shaking your head, you've had the same experience. I get in my car and I go, thank you, God, thank you, God, thank you, God. I needed to be there. And I'm rejuvenated, and I'm energized, and I feel Look what I had lost if I didn't listen to that inner voice. And sometimes, you know, I like to say, well, I'll go because so-and-so's going to be there, and I told him I'd be there. Boy, that sounds like some old ideas and attitudes, doesn't it? Yeah. Step 10. We have begun to sense the flow of the Spirit. To some extent, we have become God-conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense. That's what it is. Thank you. I didn't realize that. That's what's in my gut. That's what's in my solar plexus, that sixth sense. I just got a couple minutes here. You know, in the 11th step, our thought life, you mean my thinking, I think, will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. That's a promise if I do the 11th step. And if I pray and I look at it and I ask for God's guidance. We are often surprised how the right answers come after we've tried this for a little. Oh, man. You know, how many times have I said, I can't do this forever. I can do it for a week. And then all of a sudden, somewhere in that week, the miracle happens. And you realize, whoa, what have I been missing because of my own self-will? I'm going to end with one of the promises in working with others. And I told you about what it was like for me growing up lonely, what it was like for me as an adult being isolated. I told you about what it was like my first 10 years of sobriety. And I can remember when my sponsors, my step guide, started working with me 2 years ago. And he said, Karen, if you do what's in the big book, you will be surprised at what will happen. And people will find something. And I'm like, yeah, right, you know. Here we go. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. And I read that as, I need to watch out for that. I need to watch the fellowship grow up around me. And the thing is, I don't think I'm any different. You know, I do some different things, but I think I'm still the same person I was 12 years ago. And you probably had the same experience. People at some point in working the steps will say, you know, something's different about you. Or people will start coming up and asking you questions. Or I'll be the only one, and I'm not bragging, I'm just saying this is my experience. I go back and I visit some of those meetings that I went to for 10 years, and I walk in, I'm the only one with a big book, because that's what my sponsor told me to do, and I'm not doing it to brag. And I sit down and I listen to what people share. And what I do is, instead of saying, oh, I know what you should do because I'm a very educated person with, you know, 3 postgraduate degrees, is I start to look in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous for what would the big book tell that person? What would the big book tell them to do? You know, that's a psychic change. So I thank you very, very much for listening and for letting me do more than just my story. And thank you.